You're a Grand Old Flag, written by George M. Cohan in 1906 for his stage musical, George Washington Jr. According to Wikipedia, the title and the first lyric come from someone Cohan once met. Wiki cites this story from the website of the Library of Congress. The original lyric, as Cohan later explained, came from an encounter he had with a Civil War veteran who fought at Gettysburg. The two men found themselves next to each other, and Cohan noticed the vet held a carefully folded but ragged old flag. The man reportedly then turned to Cohan and said, "She's a grand old rag." Cohan thought it was a great line and originally named his tune, "You're a Grand Old Rag." So many groups and individuals objected to calling the flag a rag, however, that he gave them what they wanted and switched words, renaming the song, "You're a Grand Old Flag." This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we're going to talk about this most powerful symbol and what it tells us about patriotism. Our guest is historian Woden Teachout. She's the author of Capture the Flag, A Political History of American Patriotism. Teachout says over the course of our history, citizens have, in her words, harnessed the flag's power in service to disparate visions, and in doing so, they have made those visions part of the American dream. It has stood at different times for radical democracy, opposition to immigration, the abolition of slavery, unregulated capitalism, segregation, integration, and a hawkish war policy, among many other things. Listeners, your questions and comments are welcome. I look forward to your phone calls. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Woden Teachout, earned her Ph.D. in the history of American civilization from Harvard University. She is currently professor of graduate studies at Union Institute and University in Vermont. Capture the Flag is published by Basic Books. Again, the phone number is 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Woden Teachout, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Had you heard the story about you're a grand old rag?
I had. Yes, it's a wonderful story. I'm really glad you opened with that.
Yeah, yeah. The veteran Cohan met served in the Civil War. Are there accounts of how people of those war years felt about the American flag and the flags of the Confederacy?
Certainly. The Civil War veterans are important for two reasons. One is because of the Civil War itself and what a profound moment that was. And then the second reason was because of how centrally they brought the flag into American culture in the 1890s. And that would have been right around the time that song was, just before that song was written.
Yeah.
So, yeah, for the Civil War, that was the first moment at which the American flag became so present. It was everywhere. After the fall of Fort Sumter, there were flags in the North, on churches, off of homes, individual homes where they'd never been before, on businesses. People had them as handkerchiefs all over the place. And that was the first moment in which you ever see that.
Yeah. Late in December of 1860, Union soldiers had taken Fort Sumter and raised the Stars and Stripes, but in April of 61, the flag came down, and the Union soldiers had surrendered. It was a critical point for both North and South, and flags were rallying symbols.
They were. Before that, the flag had been used really primarily as a military symbol. It was first used over U.S. troops in the Mexican-American War of 1848. But in that Civil War period, right after the fall of Fort Sumter, the American flag became a symbol of union. And there were many people in the North who said, "We want this to be the symbol of abolition as well," but it really wasn't. And it took the course of the war and really the Emancipation Proclamation before the flag became a symbol not only of union but of an anti-slavery emancipation idea.
Yeah. It's interesting to note, too, that this veteran that George M. Cohan met, the flag that he carried with him might have been different from another Stars and Stripes of the period, that there wasn't yet quite a really uniform flag. Some people had flags where they thought places that should be included in the Union should be represented among the stars, and so there was the flag looked different.
It did. The period just before the Civil War and during the Civil War is fascinating for that reason, because a number of Americans played with the stars, and they said, we think that the only people, like, for example, John Brown at Harper's Ferry, who was a famous abolitionist, he said, I'm only going to include the number of stars in my flag of the states that are free. Those are the only states that legitimately belong to this country. And you had other individuals doing that, too. And so he was really using that flag as a way to claim the United States as an abolitionist country.
Hmm. Let's go back in time now to late in the 18th century. You write that prior to the American Revolution, flags were a rare sight on land and on land in the colonies. But flags played a critical role at sea. And of all those who fought in the Revolutionary War, it was seamen who embraced the flag most fervently. What was their flag, and what did it symbolize to them?
The flag was just simply not a symbol that one encountered very often on land. And if you were going to look for the flag in a revolutionary city, you'd have to go down to the harbor, because flags were used on ships, and they were used as a symbol of, it wasn't even so much as a symbol, but as a visual indicator of nationality. So when two ships approached each other at sea across that long distance of the waves, one, they could tell by looking at the flag raised on the other's mast, was this friend, was this foe? Were we going to do battle? Were we not? And so flags had that particular meaning for seamen that was very, very strong. What happened over the course of the Revolution was that the flag became a symbol for those sailors of what they were fighting for. Many sailors were part of the official navy, but many others fought on privateers, and they would be private ships that would go and capture British ships to try and hamper the British effort. And so for those sailors, the American flag became imbued with their sense of what they were about, which was in part radical democracy.
Mm. What was the prisoner's flag?
Prisoner's flag was a flag that was created in one of the British prisons. There were a number of American sailors who were held captive both on British prison ships off American coasts and then also in British prisons. And those men would take their the greatcoats of the red cloth from the greatcoats, and they would sew white stars, and they would sit in their captivity, and they would create. They created this really beautiful flag called the prisoner's flag. And you can see, actually, that imprisoned Americans in all subsequent wars have done something quite similar.
So what of Betsy Ross and Francis Scott Key?
I know. Well, this book is really not about them. I have to say that every time. That they are such wonderful stories, and they're certainly part of our national mythology, and they're very deeply ingrained in our national mythology. But those, I'm not really interested in them in this book. This book is about what ordinary Americans have done to make the flag their own and to imbue the flag with their own meanings.
Yeah. Other than the prisoners' flags, was there a revolutionary flag? Was there an American flag at the time of the Revolution?
There was a naval flag. The flag resolution that people tend to cite in 1777 was put through the Marine Committee in the Continental Congress. And so it was a flag that symbolized the U.S. naval forces, and then certainly a lot of the American ships, even if they weren't officially naval forces, used it as well.
So, but in meeting halls and so on and so forth, a flag wouldn't be in the corner of the front of the room.
No, yeah, that's not till later.
Yeah. It's interesting to see in the time of the Civil War that we have the flag as a really potent symbol of Union, and Abraham Lincoln certainly made use of the flag politically.
Yes, he did. He, as he was traveling to his inauguration from Illinois, the Fort Sumter situation was going on, and the Union troops were there, locked in Fort Sumter. And Lincoln, as he traveled, would make an issue of the flag. So, for example, it was in, I think, Pennsylvania. He raised the flag, and he said, as I'm raising this flag, it's not just me who's doing it, it's all of us who are doing it. And he really made an effort to show that the flag was something that symbolized the entire Union force. And he was trying to make the case at that point that it was both North and South, but certainly it symbolized most significantly the Union.
Here would you talk about what you call competing threads of patriotism, humanitarian patriotism and nationalist patriotism?
Yeah, what I do in the book is I use the flag, and I use these stories of the flag, and they're wonderful stories, but I use them as a window into ideas about patriotism, because the flag is a symbol most profoundly of different ideas about patriotism. And there are really two main threads. The first idea is what I call humanitarian patriotism, and that's a way of looking and thinking about patriotism where you imagine, where people say, I believe in my country as a means to getting to this other ideal. And that ideal might be democracy, that ideal might be equality, it might be equality of opportunity, something like that. But it's a means, the patriotism, the country is a means to get to that ideal.
Hmm.
Nationalist patriotism, on the other hand, is more about the country as it is. It's loyalty to the country as it stands. And so those have very different political connotations, as you can see.
Is it possible for them to fit together?
It is, absolutely. And there are moments when, for example, in the Civil War with Lincoln, you have humanitarian ideals, for example, emancipation, that are being... So that he's framing that as, here's one kind of patriotic ideal is emancipation, but he's also saying, now we have to be loyal to the Union, and there's that emphasis on loyalty and on sacrifice and on service as a means to getting to that other ideal. So both of those ideals are working in tandem.
Mm. Here we are right now, and it's important that we be Americans, but yet it is important that we continue on our struggle. And you say ultimately the flag is a challenge, its promise yet to be fulfilled.
I think so. Every generation has found that. Every generation has talked about whatever their major issues are in terms of the flag. And so, for example, if you look back at the Revolution, it's democracy. If you look at the 1840s when all these immigrants were coming into the country, it's about what does it mean to be an American? Can you be an immigrant and an American? And so every single generation uses the flag as a way to have those bigger discussions. So, of course, the meaning of the flag will continue.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about a time when the flag was used by nativists to put down immigrants. And this was in the years preceding the Civil War, following the American Revolution, obviously. What was the status of the flag in the mid-19th century?
The mid-19th century, it was very rarely seen. Again, it was not something that you would walk out of your door and see. The places where it did start to appear was on wallpaper. It began to be kind of a decorative item. But if you were to look for a symbol of the country at that point, it would be much more likely to be Lady Liberty, the goddess of liberty, something like that, and not the American flag. What happened was with all of this immigration, particularly large numbers of Irish people coming into the coastal cities, there started to be real conflicts over what the place of those Irish people and then some Germans was. You know, did they belong in this society or not? And so people who opposed them, the nativists, brought out the flag as a real symbol of anti-immigration.
So in Philadelphia in 1844, we have a really a period of rioting and really of terror. This, you say, was a critical moment in terms of how the American flag would be defined. Tell us about Louis Levin and George Schiffler.
Sure. Louis Levin is this wonderfully colorful character. He had come originally from South Carolina. He had gone to Mississippi, been run out of the state after a duel, and he finally settled in Philadelphia. And he was a teacher, he was a lawyer, he was a lecturer, and he was a newspaper editor. But when he arrived in Philadelphia, he set himself up as a temperance lecturer, which it's hard to imagine nowadays, but that was really a powerful role. There was a large movement against alcohol and for close to complete temperance at that time. Some people just said you need to be careful what you drink, but many people were advocating for total prohibition. And so Louis Levin came into town, and he set himself up in this way, and he was very colorful. He set up a big pile of whiskey barrels on the waterfront, and he set them ablaze. And he really used these wonderful, dramatic tactics to get people's attention. So he decided that temperance was interesting, but nativism was really where his fortune lay, and he began to lecture about this conflict between the Irish immigrants, many of whom were Catholic, and the native-born Protestant workers. And he really riled people up, and he got them so that the native-born Protestant ended up taking an American flag, and they started holding meetings with an American flag in these Irish neighborhoods.
And so for a time, the flag meant a white Protestant America that sought to vanquish, if not eliminate, the immigrants.
It did. And what was so interesting was that a lot of these Irish immigrants had very little patience for this, and they would knock down the flag and run the nativists out of their neighborhoods. And in one of these instances, a young man named George Schiffler, who was kind of a hanger-on, he wasn't really sort of a key part of the nativist movement, but he was one of these young men who liked to come and see where the action was. He was carrying an American flag as part of this nativist, as a nativist symbol, and the Irishman shot him. And so he was killed holding the American flag, and he became a tremendous symbol for the nativists. They said, look at this. You can't even hold an American flag in this country anymore. Look what happened to him. We have to protect against these violent Irish Catholics.
However, 3 days of rioting followed, and the nativists had a hand in it for sure.
They certainly did. They surrounded the Irish. They went back and they got all kinds of guns, and they really ravaged this Irish neighborhood. A whole group of them gathered at Independence Hall, and they had an American flag, and they marched, I think it's a couple miles even, to this Irish neighborhood, and they started setting places on fire and pulling furniture out into the streets and knocking on doors and shooting people who were inside. And one of the things that the Irish women did was they sort of saw this coming, and they quickly either posted American flags from the masthead of these nativist newspapers in their windows, or they sewed little pieces of red, white, and blue together and hung them in their windows as kind of a protection to say, look, you know, we subscribe to you enough, please don't burn our houses. But the nativists came through and they completely ravaged Philadelphia. It was a really, really awful, dramatic event.
When it was all over, what was said about what had happened?
Louis Levin, the nativist leader, he said this was the fault of the Irish. But there were many, many moderate Philadelphians who were born in this country. They were not immigrants. And they said, look, this is not the American way. They were very, very troubled by the way that Levin and the nativists had taken hold of the flag and had sort of taken this whole rhetoric of what it meant to be an American. And they really challenged that. But what was so interesting was that the nativists had the flag. And for several years afterwards, even having a flag or even speaking on the 4th of July were seen as evidence of a nativist tendency. And so the nativists really took hold of those symbols and defined them for quite a while.
Yeah, and it wasn't until really the Civil War when the meaning of the flag shifts again.
That's right, yeah. And what I've tried to do in the book is to show how there are these key moments, key events, and most of them are really quite dramatic, in which the meaning of the flag shifts. And in the Civil War is certainly one of those moments because the flag is taken into battle on behalf of the Northern troops. And so these earlier meanings, they're still there, but they recede in importance in front of these bigger contemporary meetings. Whatever the contemporary debate is, that's the thing that defines the flag the most.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is historian Woden Teachout. She is the author of Capture the Flag, A Political History of American Patriotism. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Do people of any other nation feel as strongly as we do about their flags?
You know, I was very curious about this because I had for a while sort of taken for granted that we have the strongest feeling about the flag and the strongest patriotic culture. And so I did some research, and interestingly, there is a group, I can't remember their name, but they go out and they survey people of different nations on different questions. They have a group of 34 different countries, and they surveyed asking members of these countries how they felt about their country and then asking them to articulate it according to 10 basic subpoints. And interestingly, the United States statistically answers the highest when it comes to these questions about how strongly do you feel you're a patriot to your country. But what's also interesting is that Venezuela is second, and that's not necessarily a country that you would have, or at least that I thought of. And the United States ranks its patriotism highest in certain areas, like I believe that the economy and politics and military might, and Venezuela ranks its country highest in terms of history and literature and the ability of everyone in society to have a decent wage. And so what I like about that survey is they really began to break down this idea of patriotism into its constituent parts. So, yes, we do have one of the stronger patriotic cultures.
Yeah. In other places, is the flag as elastic as it has been here?
I don't think so, largely because it is not as central a part of those other cultures. One of the reasons it's so important in the United States is because of the way it entered our popular culture after the Civil War, and that's this period of the 1890s, where, again, there was loads, massive immigration. Many of the ancestors of your listeners may well have come over during that period. And so what happened was you'd have these New York City schools, and there'd be someone from Poland and someone from Italy and someone from Spain and someone from Norway, someone from China. And the teachers and the school superintendents started to say, you know, wait a minute, you know, what do these students have in common? And so there was one man, a man named George Balch, in 1889, who set up a series of flag exercises in his New York City school, and he would allow the student who had been best behaved during the day to carry the flag, and he had little paper flags that they could pin on their clothing. And he wrote, in fact, the first Pledge of Allegiance, which is different than the one that we say now. And so these flag exercises really caught on among native-born Americans who were worried about what was happening to the country through immigration. And so that's the legacy. That's partly why the flag has been so much part of our culture and our popular culture. It's not just imposed from the government. It's not only there at official government functions. It's something that individual people have picked up and granted meaning to themselves.
Mm-hmm. Tell us the story of the pledge.
It's a really interesting story. This superintendent, George Balch, wrote what he wrote a pledge, and it went like this. We give our heads and our hearts to God and our country. One country, one language, one flag. You can really see there this sort of this idea of nationalist patriotism, of loyalty and of commitment, and then also this idea of unity and one language, and that's very much part of his pledge. What happened then was that Francis Bellamy, who was a Christian socialist minister who'd been kicked out of the Baptist church because he was so radical, he looked at this pledge and he said, you know, this is really kind of juvenile. I don't like this at all. And he wrote the pledge that we know now. And his interest in doing it was to provide a way for Americans to really provide a socialist critique of the rampant really unregulated capitalism that was going on at that point. And so he wanted to make sure that there was this humanitarian piece in there too. And so that's where you get For Liberty and Justice for All. So he was hired by a youth magazine, which was a young people's magazine, and he wrote the pledge and he publicized it through this magazine. And the first pledge was performed at the Chicago Exposition of 1893. And it was people all across the country, students all across the country did it, as well as at that exposition. But one of the things that was so interesting was that as they said the pledge, their hands were raised upward in a salute that was very similar to the Heil Hitler salute. And so that part of the pledge, when it came to World War II, was very quickly changed to the hand over heart.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. A radical socialist gave us the pledge.
A radical socialist gave us the pledge. It is a story that not many people know. Yeah.
Yeah. And tell us the story of how it was later, too. It was even after the Second World War that the words "under God" were inserted into the pledge.
You know, I don't cover that in the book.
Yeah.
That's, I'm really interested. I think that's a fascinating and a wonderful addition, but I'm most interested in the political implications of these different stories.
Yeah. It is so interesting to see these great themes repeat through our history, race and immigration.
Race and immigration and class.
And class.
I would also add class. I think that one of the most fascinating things for me has been seeing how the flag has been very much a working people's flag. And part of that is because of military service and the burden that working people, they always take more of the burden of fighting wars and of being in the military. And so you see those three themes really repeated.
Well, thinking of class, we can go all the way back to the years before the American Revolution. Talk about the Stamp Act of 1765.
Sure. The Stamp Act is so interesting because this is the moment at which you really start to have the colonists beginning to think of themselves as opposite to the British. And they're not really articulating a full American patriotism at that point. It's not possible. But what they're starting to do is they're starting to say, we're resisting the British, and there may be a, sort of an American patriotism, although that's not quite the right word yet, that can set us apart from the British. And so the Stamp Act began with King George's announcement that that he was going to impose a stamp tax on pieces of paper, and that meant all pieces of paper that were used in the colony. That meant newspapers, it meant writing paper, anything, books, anything that had paper was going to require a stamp, and that stamp was going to be the tax. And the colonies were very, very experiencing a very difficult depression at that point, which was strongest in the seafaring towns. And so in Boston, a number of these workers, these sailors and rope makers, waterfront workers, got together, and they were very troubled by the Stamp Act, and they got together with this group of people who were the Loyal Nine, and they were more upper class. They were brewers and printers and probably sort of upper middle class is the best analogy now. And so the two of them together hatched this protest, the Stamp Act protest, and hung an effigy from the tree, from the Liberty Tree in Boston, and they had people set lined up stamping goods that came into town in a mock stamping ceremony saying, look, when the Stamp Act goes into effect, this is how much money you're going to have to pay. And so at the end of the day, the workers cut down this effigy from the Liberty Tree and carried it through town and ended up having a bonfire at the mansion of the stamp distributor. A number of the workers went in after the Loyal Nine had left and destroyed very specific things. They didn't take anything, but they shattered the glass and the carriages and the wine, each of which was a symbol of Andrew Oliver, the stamp distributor's upper-class status. And you could kind of see this class anger becoming unleashed a little bit, which was a very interesting and somewhat difficult experience for the Loyal Nine. They didn't quite know what to do with this.
Yeah. I think they were, if I'm recalling correctly, that part of the book, it seems to me that you paint them as rather horrified.
They are, yeah, indeed, yeah. Because they had wanted to set up a protest against the Stamp Act, but they hadn't wanted, and they had set it up in these terms about hierarchy, but they hadn't want that hierarchy to be turned around and imposed on social relations in the United States.
When did the colonists begin calling themselves Americans?
That is an interesting question. I'm not sure I can answer that specifically. There's certainly an idea of America, but long before the Revolution, and there's an idea of the colonies as their own separate place. Benjamin Franklin writes this essay in which he talks about how amazing the colonies are, and America is, partly because of population growth, and you can really see how everything thrives in this country. But certainly by 1778, you have these sailors who are stuck in a British prison talking very clearly about themselves as Americans. That's very strongly an identity.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is historian Woden Teachout. She is the author of Capture the Flag, A Political History of American Patriotism. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, let's go back and talk now about another couple of the themes that we've touched on already this afternoon, immigration and race. How did the Klan come to take up the American flag?
The Klan, it's such an interesting story, partly because the flag under the Klan meant segregation and it meant white supremacy. And then 40, 50 years later, you have the flag being used as a symbol of the civil rights movement. So there's this fascinating trajectory there. The founder of the 20th century Klan was a man named William Simmons, and he lived in Atlanta. He was a member of all kinds of clubs, the Elks and the Masons and a number of others, and he had this vision of starting his own civic organization, essentially. And he heard about the birth of a nation, the D.W. Griffiths movement, which was a which looked back at the Klan, and he had memories of the Klan very vaguely from his own childhood, from the Civil War Klan. And so he decided, okay, I'm gonna form this civic organization based on the Klan and the Ku Klux Klan. And so he got a number of his friends. There were 15 friends plus Simmons, and they drove to the base of Stone Mountain one evening in a rented bus. And they switched on their electric flashlights, and they hiked all the way up to the top of Stone Mountain. And Simmons had set up, he had a real eye for ritual, and so he had each of the men bring a boulder, and they created an altar there. And he put on the altar three symbols that he thought were really powerful: clear, pure spring water, the Bible, and an American flag that his father had given him. And it's clear that he doesn't know quite what he's going to do with the American flag at that point. He knows that it's got a kind of a patriotic bent to this organization, and it's sort of about white supremacy, but it doesn't have a clear agenda at that point. And so what happens then is that you have World War I, and during that period, Simmons uses the Klan to go around and to act as really a vigilante group, and they find draft dodgers, and they beat them up, and they find prostitutes who are hanging around the military bases, and they harass them, and they, when shipyard workers are striking for better wages, they go in and they beat them up as well, saying you can't strike during the war. And so Simmons really uses the Klan as kind of a very unofficial arm of U.S. policy, and sees himself as a vigilante arm of the government. And after the war, they still wanted to continue this kind of activity. It was very much part of the way they saw themselves. But after the war, the Klan really took on a focus on race, and there were some new organizers who came in and who saw race as this key issue that could very powerfully galvanize large numbers of people. And so these organizers went around and they started talking about immigrants and African-Americans and actually socialists as well. And they started doing the night riding at that period. So what's really amazing is you have the Ku Klux Klan, a very popular American organization in many ways. There was a big debate over it, but the president, Warren Harding, was sworn in as a member of the Klan in the green room of the White House during his tenure in office. And so it really was, despite the debate, it was clearly many people saw it as an American organization, and it was symbolizing clearly segregation and white supremacy. And then, of course, it goes on to be a symbol of the civil rights movement.
Yeah, that's interesting, too. That's coming up next. Now we have children carrying the American flag as a symbol of civil rights in Jackson.
Yeah, in Jackson, Mississippi, Medgar Evers, civil rights organizer, had noticed that whenever he had his people go downtown and picket, the picket signs would be taken away. And so he said, well, what if we use the American flag? He's part of the civil rights movement, and he himself is a World War II veteran, and as he's come back to this country, he said, all those rights that I fought for overseas, I want to see them available for black people in the South. And so he organized this march with 600 young African-American students in Jackson, Mississippi, and they all gathered in a church, and they were carrying American flags and singing freedom songs, and they walked out of the church, and they walked down the street and turned the corner, and they saw Mississippi law enforcement right there in the street blocking their way. There were police officers and state police officers, and there were garbage trucks. And these police officers herded those kids right into the garbage trucks and took them away, grabbing their flags. And some of them were taken away, but some of them were dropped to the ground and broken under these boots. And so when the children were all taken away, there was this street, and there were broken American flags all along the street. And it was a very powerful image. One woman picked up one of the flags and started to cry, because it symbolized the fact that these children were making a claim to be included in the American dream and were being denied that claim.
Where are we today?
I think the flag is really at a moment of redefinition. For the last 40 years, with some exceptions, it's really been a pretty strong symbol of the political right, and I put the roots of that in Vietnam era. And then with the election of Obama, things really shifted, and you had a lot of people saying, you know, I've always felt this great distance from the flag, but now I don't, and I feel like I want to go out and buy a flag. So I would say that the flag is really up for grabs at this particular moment. I don't see it as strongly a symbol of either political party or of any particular social groups. It's, you know, it's there, and it's open for definition. It's a very interesting moment.
Did September 11th affect how we see the flag?
Very much. September 11th was very much in keeping with Pearl Harbor, for example. You know, a great American tragedy, and Americans responded by displaying the flags really as a symbol of unity. And I would say that the political implications of the flag at that moment, right after September 11th, really receded before this sense of the flag as being a flag of grief and resilience and a country, and making a pledge to the sense of wholeness of what it could mean to be an American. And then, of course, after September 11th, the flag was used very explicitly as a symbol of the buildup to war. And so it took on political connotations quite quickly after that, and I think that that's what many people responded to when they responded so negatively to flags during that period.
Yeah. It seems right at the moment we really have one foot in nationalist patriotism and humanitarian patriotism.
I think so, yeah. Yeah, and it's and what's so interesting is not just the flag itself, but the rhetoric of patriotism. And what Obama has done is he's tried to kind of distinguish between the two of them. You know, certainly there was the whole flag pin flap, and which he was distancing himself from the flag, but he also very, very consciously uses the language of patriotism. It's really quite striking when you look at his stump speech And when you look at his acceptance speech in Grant Park in November, there's he talks about patriotism, and he tries to talk about both kinds of patriotism, which is interesting. It's a very conscious choice on his part, I believe.
Going back in time now, when we had on the left, we saw people pulling away from the American flag and its symbolism. What happened there? Was it the Vietnam War in that period and Richard Nixon? When did that happen?
I would say there's a very specific moment, and that is a protest in 1967 in Central Park. Before that moment, you saw flags really across the political spectrum. The flag was certainly a very important symbol for those families who had sons or brothers or fathers serving in the military in Vietnam. But it was also a symbol that you could see at anti-war gatherings as they heated up. And so you saw American flags, and people were very consciously using the flag in that way. In 1967, there was the biggest political protest up until that date. It was, I think, 300,000 people in New York Central Park, and this was the protest at which you have this famous photographs of people burning their draft cards. And so there was a draft card burning, and then right next to the draft card burning, there were these two young men, and they said, well, you know, we can go one better. We can burn an American flag. And you can see there's a photograph of the event, and you can see the men lighting on fire the flag, and you can see the crowd around them and the level of seriousness, and nobody's cheering. It's a very powerful sense of really disapproval coming from that flag. But the photographer took the picture, and that picture was in newspapers all across the country, and it generated this debate that we still have about flag burning.
Yeah, it still comes up every now and then. Should we have an amendment to the Constitution?
It does.
Banning flag burning.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, it was quite controversial. I remember someone appearing on television. I was pretty young, wearing an American flag. I want to say it was the Tonight Show.
Oh, yes.
It was a
Yippie. I cannot remember his name right now, but
Abby Hoffman.
Abby Hoffman. That's it. Yeah, okay. Yeah. And what's so interesting about that story is that he apparently bought this famous flag shirt, and I think he appeared on the television, and then he also came in front of the House Committee on Un-American Activities, and he bought this flag shirt off the rack at some department store. So it was not that he had sewn it himself out of a flag. It was something that people were wearing, but the way he was wearing it, and the level of sort of the way he was flaunting that symbol and the meaning of that symbol for people proved very, very powerful. And that really helped catalyze that whole sense of flag desecration as well.
It's very interesting because today, especially in the months of June and July, flag apparel is everywhere.
It is. And the early people who worried about flag desecration would have been absolutely shocked. They thought that the flag was for flying and not for wearing. And they really... They saw that as flag desecration.
Yeah. Well, back to the early 20th century and George Balch pinning paper flags on students in school in New York. Was that the first? Could we say that there we have the roots of the flag pin?
Of the flag pin. Yes. There, and then in the election of 1896, which was obviously just a couple years later, the campaign manager for William McKinley, the Republican candidate, wore a button that instead of saying McKinley, it simply had a picture of the flag. And so that that also, I think, is an important moment at which the flag pin was started to be used politically.
Yeah, okay. So it was the late 19th century, not the 20th century. When and how did flag pins become de rigueur?
There have been a number of moments, and one of them is in that late, the first flag pin is politically used is really in that 1896. Also, when Woodrow Wilson went into Congress to sign the bill that announced that we would go into World War I, all the supporters of U.S. involvement in World War I were standing there wearing flag pins, and all the people who were opposed were not. And those flag pins had been distributed ahead of time as a symbol of sort of collapsing these two ideas. One is of American patriotism, and one is of this specific idea that we should go into World War One. So you have that, and then they really emerge with a vengeance right around 1970. And you have a number of, after this flag burning in Central Park, people started wearing them, civilian people, and then Nixon picked up on it and began wearing them, and his whole entire cabinet wore flag pins as a prelude to his 1972, as part of his 1972 campaign.
Hmm. There, we've got to leave it. We're out of time. Wooden Chow, thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
It's a very fine book. Capture the Flag, A Political History of American Patriotism. Very interesting. Lots of wonderful stories in this book. The book is published by Basic Books. Our guest, Wooden Teachout, earned her Ph.D. in the History of American Civilization from Harvard. She's currently professor of graduate studies at Union Institute and University in Vermont. Capture the Flag, A Political History of American Patriotism, published by Basic Books.